Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, our Week in Sports Cars episode with my co-pilot, my friend, my European reporter of distinction, another new word I've made up.
Daily it's one of those...
It's distinct... ...coms, Graham, good,
Is distinction quite close to Saskatchewan? Is that one of those Canadian provinces?
It's definitely in the Goodwin... lineal arc, I think, for sure. So, yeah, and for those of you who prefer English, welcome to the Week in Sports Cars, presented by Cooper Tires. I'm your co-host, Marshall Pruitt. Why? Well, it's my podcast. Kind of funny how that works out. And, hey, I cover sports cars, mostly in North America. Guess who's on the other end? Graham Goodwin. He covers sports cars, mostly not in North America. What do you know? And we talk about it here, and you send in questions, and we answer them. Occasionally with intelligence. So
absolutely.
Should we do
How
that?
Often do we do that? Every
know.
Week.
Yeah, every week. And we're 2 months or so shy of our 1 year anniversary of
really
clogging people's ears with this nonsense. But yes, here we are again.
We should get a cake, mate.
Yes. You might have just finished last week's episode if you started listening on Thursday or Friday. Thanks for those of you who persevered through last week's. It was like an old double album. Thank you for listening through what was just basically a double episode, double the amount of questions piled into one episode, because the previous week before, we had some technical difficulties that did not allow us to get to them. So all of that aside, we are going to do our absolute finest to stick to our 90-minute format, even to the point of I have a stopwatch running in front of me, Graham, and we are at 1 minute and 58 seconds, 59, 2 minutes. So, hey, we've already burned 2 minutes of me stumbling through the English language. What should we start off with first, my friend?
Let's go to ACO World first this week. We've clearly not got any WEC racing until next year now, until March and Sebring, but there's plenty going on. And I know what a lot of listeners are looking forward to is the final approval, we all hope and expect, in just a few days' time, of the regulations for the 2020-2021 season, the hypercar, car car, LMP1, future, you name it, whatever it's going to be, we will get to hear whether or not that is the real book that's going to carry forward. What do we know? We know that it was discussed at the Endurance Commission as planned beginning of last month. We know that that came up with a couple of minor points that needed to be clarified and worked upon, but that the regulations did go forward to the FIA for approval, which I would estimate is pretty much a formality, that we should be getting at least an outline nod in the communique that comes from the World Motorsport Council on December the 6th, I want to say, so later this week, that yes, that is what's going to come forward to. What it won't tell us, MP, is what it's going to be called, because what we also know is the intention of the ACO, the FIA, LMEM, is that that, at least part of that decision, will be open to a choice which you, the listener, you, the fan, you, the enthusiast, will have a part to play in, I believe, drilling down into a list of 10 possibilities.
Hashtag car car.
Car car.
Or, and we might have to pay you off, dear listeners, write in, let's call the class the Week in Sports Cars. I mean, let's just really, if we're trying to think of promotions, what better way than to name an entire class after our show?
That'd be great.
It would also lead to a worldwide backlash because people would make up their own names.
Twisk One.
Yes, Twisk One. I believe I saw a naughty movie with a similar name. Well, I did speaking of car, car, hypercar, I did spend about an hour on the phone with our mutual friend, Jim Glickenhaus.
Always a pleasure.
Hypercar, his interests in IMSA / SRO GT3 based production and a whole bunch of good stuff. So I'm going to post that here probably right after this goes up. But let's start off with, you got to a little bit of it, and since the ACO world tends to be your specialty, I will be the navigator here to pose most of the questions, starting with our man Stuart Hart, who says, hypercar regs are imminent, but what will we discover? Are the full regs going to be published? Will we get details such as customer car / drivetrain availability and costs? Will we get containments, commitments? What do you think we're going to get from potential entrants? I do think the ACO needs something of a PR blitz.
I completely agree with the latter points, Stuart, and good evening to you. We will simply get, I believe, a confirmation from the World Motorsport Council that they approve those regulations. We know already, we've had discussed with us in some depth what the outline for those will be. We will, I believe, have confirmation that the there will have to be a commercial cap on the cost of the hybrid aspect of the powertrain to any customer, and that the cost that was laid out in the draft that we've had discussions about with those powers that be is the €2 million for a two-car team for a full season part of it. That isn't the cost of production and development of that. It's the cost that any manufacturer that chooses to enter must offer their hybrid system commercially to any customer that wishes to buy it at. That is something that is a condition of the regulations. I know it's been part of the controversy as to what that means in terms of the sustainability of the regulations, but that is what we expect to be a part of it. Will we get commitments or comment from potential entrants? That is for them. It won't certainly come as part of the announcement from the FIA. That is not their place. It is for the potential competitors to come forward. As you've heard me say on previous shows, my belief is beyond, as Marshall says, Jim Glickenhaus and his fine people looking to bring forward a program for year one. I think we'll see Toyota in year one. I'm not sure who else we'll see in year one, but I'm pretty darn sure that we're closing in on something pretty spectacular for year two. So I think we will start to see a bit of a trickle of announcements, but yes, I think so that we can start to try to park some of the cynicism that's been about this development. It is very much, in my mind, a commercial stopgap. You know, it's got some visual relevance, it's got some technical relevance, but it's a commercial stopgap before the technology matures and we start to get to where I think they actually would rather we were, which is the kind of zero emissions formula. But we're going to have to wait about half a decade for that. But that, too, looking pretty positive. I think we can all afford to take half a step back and wait to see what emerges here.
Let's go to Anders Oz next, who asks a question that occurred to me as well. What's up with the ACO going to a two-phase Le Mans entry announcement? Just trying to manufacture some extra anticipation, or is there something else going on, Graham?
Well, the answer here is it's in part a knock-on effect of a change in the calendar for the Asian Le Mans series. Those that are followers of a lot of endurance racing will remember that we, generally speaking, have had the announcement of the WEC entry list, which it'll be, I believe, two things we'll have mentioned here: the Le Mans 24 Hours and the European Le Mans series, because WEC, of course, hasn't finished yet. But it's because we've had a delay, or rather a switch in dates for the end of the Asian Le Mans series, that means that the traditional date for the announcement, we won't know who's won those auto entries. Now, that clearly has an impact, particularly bearing in mind the teams that have entered the Asian Le Mans series this year, on whether or not those teams would wish to be considered as part of the potential cabal of European Le Mans series entries that we're looking for spaces. What it does tell us, because it's only, I think, 10 entries that will be kind of carried over, is just what a small slice of the European Le Mans series potential entrants are going to be on that official list when we get to June. That's because something around 36. We have 36 full season entries, two of which, as listeners will be aware, the two Ginettas, we'll come to those, by the way, in a moment, have not been at every race. So, you know, 34 to 36 entries are already effectively inked in, plus I think it's 15 auto entries from various means. So when you start to add those figures up, you start to get to actually a really very small total indeed that you've got to split between Asian Le Mans series that aren't title winners, European Le Mans series that aren't title winners, anybody from IMSA, and I can tell you there's at least one that are looking to enter this season as well to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Plus, of course, the pro cars that the factories might seek to come again, as they have done in previous years, from the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. So it is a tough, tough year if you're looking to attract the attention of the selection committee. The reason it's been split, I'm pretty certain, is linked in to that toughness and the fact that, for instance, for the sake of arguing, it seemed like United Autosports, who currently have no auto entries but clearly would like to get both of their Ligiers in, if they're successful in one or two or three of the titles that they stand to compete for in the Asian Le Mans series, that makes their life a bit easier and also takes a little bit of pressure off the numbers coming from the European Le Mans series. That's what it's all about.
I love it. I love it. Let's go to our pal, Right Turn Lover. It wouldn't be an episode of The Week in Sports Cars without a Right Turn Lover question, who asks, in 2016, the Ferrari and Ford GTE offerings were the head of the class at Le Mans on the 50th anniversary of their classic battle. Porsche was ahead of the field in 2018 on the 70th anniversary. Could we expect a Corvette resurgence at the 2019 Le Mans, the 20th anniversary for the Corvettes?
Oh, you cheeky scamp, Right Turn Lover. it has to be said, it's not the first time that someone has mentioned to me, and by the way, this is people from the factory teams, you know, that we're a little way from needing to build the best car to win Le Mans, you just need an anniversary. That might be marginally cynical, but at times it has seemed that the balance of performance has been somewhat skewed. I don't expect Corvette racing to be anything other than entirely competitive, to be honest with you. Forget for a moment what happened in Shanghai. That was, you know, a track that the guys did not have data for. They were always going to be on the back foot to the teams that have been doing Shanghai for year after year after year. I expect that with the C7R, in what I expect to be its final full season with the team, they're going to come out and come up punching. And yes, of course, when they've got something to actually push for, they will be looking to see what they can possibly do to be in as good a shape as they possibly can. I do expect, by the way, we're going to see a single Corvette in the WEC race at Sebring. That will mean, although Corvette racing will not have an auto BOP in the WEC prior to Le Mans, it will mean at least that the ACO has got two races worth of data on the right tyres, on the same tracks, to compare and contrast with the other established full season entrants. That may, in at least in part, be part of the plan for the Corvette racing crew, because one of the things that we have heard repeatedly, usually privately, on the odd occasion, bad temperedly and publicly, that they've not been very happy with the BOP that's been actually levied out.
This is the first time we might be hearing about folks being displeased by BOP. So a topic we might need to explore in future episodes. We're going to go to our pal Stathis Coco, who says, at DSC editor, that being your Twitter handle, I know that I raised a case of cost thing about the WEC, but since you work as a part of that team, could you please make a contact with them and tell them some things about the subscription? I believe referring to the live streaming service. Since I paid for the whole subscription, I'd like to have full races available there pre-2016 and pre-WEC. So is this something you can take up with our friends at the WEC to backfill their streaming catalog?
I have had many conversations with several people at WEC about the charging regime, the quality of service that has been shown to some customers about the live stream. The full races, I completely agree with you. Pre-WEC, I think you'd be lucky there, to be honest with you. But full races from 2012, I'd love to see that as part of the service. I think it should be part of the service. If you're actually charging a premium rate, then there should be a premium service. And whilst there are some things you can access through the app that aren't available to broadcast customers, frankly, I always think it pays dividends to over-provide. So be assured, Stathis, we do have regular discussions with that. What influence I've got, my guess is not a huge amount, but as I often say, and we've often said, the best way to influence these things is find the right address, write to that address, keep it clean, keep it respectful, make your point forcefully around how big a fan you are and the contribution you're making and the number of people you think agree with you, and people will honestly eventually listen.
Oh, I'm sorry, are you done there? My bad.
I'm done.
I wasn't listening. I apologize. sorry, we're going to go to Trawavasaurus or Trawavasaurus or Trawavasaurus. At the end of a year that's had its fair share of LMP1 team budget issues, how much development can we expect to see over the short break before Sebring regarding to suspension development to make the most of new tires included?
Well, bearing the LMP1 privateer teams can do a lot more than, for instance, Toyota can. Toyota more or less committed to leaving their car alone. It comes down to availability of budget and a willingness to invest, you know, in the current state of performance. I can tell you that in the background there is at least one major proposal for a big step forward for an existing LMP1 privateer car, and that potentially involves several factors around that package. Clearly, the weather around the proposed Michelin tire test didn't help, but it should give listeners an opportunity to kind of think along the lines of what is actually in the mix here. They clearly can do things with aero. That comes at a cost. Remember that a lot of the engine development that was coming forward for this season was pretty late coming. We had a late commitment from a number of these programs. Remember, for instance, the Rebellion team didn't hit the track until the prologue with that car. And there's been precious little time, really, for meaningful testing and development in the interim period. So I think it comes down to some really pretty tough conversations about whether or not anybody is going to commit to that level of expenditure. But I would tell you this much. I think in terms of what we saw from the quicker of the privateer LMP1s at Shanghai, in terms of pace, I think there's a lot of encouragement. I was hearing numbers from sensible people in privateer land that they expected that on ultimate pace, they'd be within 0.2 or 0.3 of a second of the Totas. Bear in mind what monsters those TSO50s are. That's pretty spectacular. Putting EOT aside for a moment, I think they can dare to dream. And I think certainly moving into year two of the current situation, after the Le Mans 24 hours, I think most people expect that there is not going to be the level of, how can we put this, leverage and influence from Toyota that perhaps they've had in this year. I do expect Toyota will be there. I don't expect Toyota to be given quite as much of a buy, if you like, in performance terms as they've had throughout this year.
You are just a fact and knowledge spouting monster today, Mr. Goodwin, and we're about to get to some deeper waters here. Tyler Kinghorn asks, would removing the fuel flow restrictions from the LMP1 privateers allow them to get closer to the Toyotas? Thoughts on the WC going back to traditional pit stops as well?
Well, 2 points there. I mean, the traditional pit stops, I think, is entirely the correct thing to do. I had the conversations leading into this season. I was not convinced by the reasons being given for it. It was supposed to be, you know, basically to improve the show. The reality is, if you're going to do that, then frankly, you should have said, right, you can have 23 people to put the car through the pit stop, as you would in a Formula One pit stop. If you're not going to do that, then let's not compare, you know, apples with gooseberries. And let's get on with this, because what it has done is to remove a key part of strategy. And I think that's the point that has now been received loud and clear by a lot of people telling, frankly, anybody that would listen, not just the likes of me. I've been doing it, some of my media colleagues have been doing it, the teams have been doing it, the drivers have been doing it, and the fans have been doing it. And that's what I meant when I said a little earlier. Respectful debating points or points to be made into the right ears can have an effect. It's so much more effective doing it that way with a fact base behind you than, you know, screaming at the internet. I find, you know, the process of screaming at a keyboard is never productive. I think we are dealing with people that genuinely want to carry this package forward, you know, with strength. And I'm very glad to see that. As for the fuel flow restrictions, I'm not quite sure whether or not you mean in the pit stop or whether or not you mean on track. Clearly, whilst there's not a vast amount of difference in terms of the on-track performance, the area where there is a distinct disadvantage for the non-hybrid cars is in the pit stops. The fuel flow restrictor means that the amount of fuel going into the cars takes 5 seconds longer into the non-hybrids. It's a lot more fuel going in, but there is a restrictor that keeps that gap. And the second part of it is that the amount of fuel that they're actually allowed means that on a regular non-Le Mans track, they're able to cover, in green flag running it on a dry track, something around 2 laps less than the Totas. That, to my mind, that's not an acceptable state of affairs. That is a false performance restriction, and the point I do get it. I understand the argument. The argument is that the Toyota is the more efficient package and must be seen to be being the more efficient package. In other words, it can go further. For my money, that's my job, you know, with a microphone in my hand or a keyboard at my disposal, to make the point, yes, they're taking exactly the same time in the pit stops, but that Rebellion or that SMP BR1 is taking on double the amount of fuel for the same mileage. That's remarkable efficiency from the hybrid. That's a lot easier a way of explaining it to, you know, a savvy audience than the way we're left to do it now, which is to explain why you need a rule set that basically takes keeps the cars longer in pit lane. For me, I think there's a simple answer to what could be done immediately, but I think is more likely to be done in the shadow of Le Mans next year. And I hope and pray, frankly, that we do see it, because at the moment, I think it's a false restriction on performance and opportunity. You know, it's not helped this year that the Toyotas have been pretty ironclad reliable, which has meant it's come down to not just performance, but reliability as well. And of course, the newer cars have been the privateer cars, and they, generally speaking, have been the ones that have hit trouble.
Man, all right, we're just going to keep cranking. You're a machine. Yeah. Here. I love it.
Yeah.
We're going to go to our man, Phil. And Phil, thank you for sending this in. Definitely worth noting that we do our best to get to as many questions as possible every week. We are unable to get to every question every week, though. And if you have something that you really want answered, it might take 2 tries. It might, in this case, take 3 tries. But keep sending them in. We will get to them eventually. And this is what's happened with our man, Phil, who says, 3rd try of this question. Would love to know what, if any, limitations on the Sebring 1000 kilometer there might be if extended yellows or code 60, say, result in an hour of expected runtime overrun, a bit like your 90 minutes, Marshall. Thank you. Or we just get 1,000 kilometers of racing no matter what. So good question. If we have a propensity of pace car time, code 60 time, delays, do you foresee any adjustment to what Americans expect, which is pretty much all the racing possible? Or do you expect things to be a traditional, hey, the race is meant to last this length, and we can't guarantee what's going to happen, but once we get to that length of either time or distance, the checkered flag's waving?
Well, I have to tell you, I've messed up here, because I meant to check the regulations before we started recording this, because
so
it will
make something up. Just make
I'll
it
make
up
something up.
And tell Eduardo Freitas. That's
it will most certainly be in the regulations as to whether or not you run to a distance or to a time. Now, traditionally, back in the days of the Le Mans series and into the end of the Le Mans series and into RLMC, we moved from a distance-based formula of racing into a time-based formula, principally because of TV time. What I feel the need to do while we're answering other questions is check the regulations. I'll come back to that one while we're doing it.
Fair enough. Well, let me grab something different. All right, let's go to 4S GTE. A little bit of a long setup here. Why isn't the WC schedule made to avoid clashes with championships like IMSA, Formula E, Super GT, and DTM, where many of its drivers also race? Instead, the organizers have stated that their primary aim is to avoid clashes with Formula One, where, bar one exception, none of its drivers race. why? And so it's a good question, Graham. Obviously, FIA is involved. Formula One, they consider to be the pinnacle of everything, but other championships that might not be their own. But, you know, how's this? All the major championships kind of talk or communicate in some way.
Yep.
Why no alignment?
Well, okay, first things first. One of the things that's not covered there for SGTE is the fact that it is an FIA championship, and there are a finite number of FIA officials to go around. That's why, if you recall, the shenanigans this coming year to do with the timing of the Japanese Formula One Grand Prix and the WEC race in Japan, it's because some of the people who are working those events can't be in two places at one time. So you can't have one World Championship event at Suzuka and the other one kind of, you know, down the road, a very, very long road, in Fuji. So that's one of the answers. I guess one of the other answers is this. You do name check a number of championships. Putting aside IMSA, and to a degree, Formula E, the reality is that Super GT and DTM are not world championships. And you've got to ask yourself, whose job is it to align with whom? It's not all on one calendar. It's actually comes down to whether or not the manufacturers, the teams, the drivers have an interest from those championships in aligning themselves around what I think to most people would say in terms of four-wheel motorsport is the second largest of the FI World Championships, albeit not as strong as it was two or three years ago, but still it is the FI World Championship. So I would caution anybody from saying it's all on one. As for IMSA, well, we've had some shenanigans here in terms of there being clashes around, but don't assume that when you hear the calendar or a change to calendar, that's something that's been plucked out of thin air. These things are discussed for many, many months. And I certainly know of one of our colleagues getting himself into all sorts of hot water by implying in some way, in a frankly unbelievably asinine fashion, that in some way this was done deliberately. It's not done deliberately. What it comes down to is that you've got to look at these events once you've looked at all the available alternatives as being it's got to be the organizer of the events determining what is best for their product. Yes, you can try and take into account other products that have got some parallel interest, but the reality is that the vast majority of the decisions that are actually made about clashing are done with the best of intentions to try to get the best solution. Yes, there are some packages out there that I suspect there's rather less concern about whether or not there's a clash. And I don't, for instance, think there's a huge amount of interest from WEC or indeed from SRO about not clashing with various events. But I don't feel that that's the case for the most part with IMSA. And in fact, a lot of work has gone on in the recent past to make sure that's accommodated, including, for instance, IMSA making sure that there's the opportunity for their full season entrants to race and have enough time to get their people to where they might need to be, for instance, to the Le Mans test or indeed any of the other races. Yes, we've had some really unfortunate, frankly, not particularly well handled instances. The Alonso Gate issue with Fuji was very clumsy. And, you know, I have nothing more to say other than it was very clumsy and it didn't reflect on anybody involved particularly well. But I certainly would not put all of this in one basket. It's not all to do with the ACO, LMEM. And as you quite rightly say, MP, there is a constant dialogue between the major race organisers and promoters as to where calendars actually sit. It is a fiercely complex matter. But I think I could probably tell you, I think I'm right that it is, with one week's exception, the first weekend that my guys on Daily Sports Car have not been covering some form of major continental or international sports car and endurance race. The first weekend since March will be the weekend before Christmas.
Wow. Well, the other thing to note, too, just quickly to follow up, if we look at some of the examples cited, particularly IMSA being North America's grandest domestic Sports Car Championship Super GT fitting that same bill for Japan, DTM fitting that same bill for Germany. In essence, we have all, and granted, while the ACO and FIA's WEC is a globe-trotting series, you know, we do have a situation where that might carry the biggest name globally, if we blanket it in that sense. It doesn't mean that to IMSA it is secondary. Super nope. GT doesn't look at itself as secondary, nor does a DTM. So you have an interesting situation where you would think it would be cool if the WEC would say, hey, to your point, we have a lot of folks that play with us that come in from other disciplines. How can we accommodate the others? The flip side, you might say, but those are all domestic championships. Shouldn't they try and sort their plans to fit the bigger blanketing one? In reality, everyone looks at themselves as the number one. And while they do try and accommodate where possible, that doesn't always happen. There really isn't a parent-child relationship here, even though we know that one is greater than the others. But yeah, so there really isn't that blinking in this game of scheduling chicken. No one's blinking for the most part. So as our pal Juan Montoya is fond of saying, it is what it is. And hey, we're just past the half hour mark, just into 31 minutes. Look at that. Our little stopwatch is working just fine. And we've got, we're more than halfway through ACO World here. Let's get into one that has, we've got a multi-part question. Four parts coming in from Joseki 100. First one, Graham, how much winter testing is scheduled for the various LMP1 teams before Sebring and where? Is there any privateer able to keep up with Toyota's testing schedule?
Well, the answer is they can if they want to, but it's going to cost them money. And the other thing is, it depends on whether or not their cars were in a container and on the oceans at the moment, or, as with Toyota's cars, were actually airlifted back to Cologne. We do expect Toyota to go testing at Sebring for the very first time. Before then, some of the other teams, of course, do have some experience over the bumps. But the reality there is that this is a very well-funded factory effort against less well-funded privateer efforts. And this is one of the ways in which, if you like, an unfair, actually in reality, completely fair advantage can be drawn by the factory teams. So in terms of how much testing is actually expected, I've not checked the testing schedules. Those have to be published and have to be made available to the other teams, and there are restrictions on the days of testing within a given season that the teams can actually have. But I wouldn't be at all surprised to see other cars appearing, particularly at Sebring, in the weeks before what looks set to be, well, how can I put this, a very busy doubleheader indeed between the WEC and the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship.
All right, let's go to part two. When can we expect to see Michelin's new tires for privateers to debut?
If it happens, and I think this is more to do with compound rather than construction, if it happens, I think you're probably likely to see something moving forward in time for Spa, not for Sebring. So I think if there's going to be that change, I think we're talking about Spa, which gives obviously the teams an opportunity to test that in real-world race conditions before taking them to the daddy, to Le Mans in June. So I think that's what we're looking at in terms of a schedule.
Based on the 2018 leg of the Super Season, which Toyota crew would you say has performed better so far, and which crew is your favorite pick for the driver's title?
As for the driver's title, I think when push comes to shove, we know where that's the best headline. Cynical answer, but that's the truth. The reality is, I think that would be... We're not yet at a point where there might be a question that says Fernando is quicker than you, but I struggle to find a situation where that might not come. As for who has performed better so far, frankly, I think every single one of the six has performed extremely well. Mike Conway, I think, has been a revelation to some people. We've seen what he could do in a P2 car not that long ago. He took his time to get up to speed, as many people do, in a very different driving discipline. But I think Mike Conway has been a standout talent this year for the Toyota team. Kamui Kobayashi is just plain fast, astoundingly so. The number 8 crew, I think it's as quick a sports car racing crew as we've seen in modern history. And frankly, whatever happens, I think there will be deserved world champions. Forget the cynicism of what's happening with the OT. I think the reality is, even if they were going head-to-head here, which they patently have not been, the reality is, I'm afraid that the opposition here would have been trounced. For me, I think five very, very good performances. I think Pechito Lopez has still got something to prove, although his speed is coming. It's perfectly understandable and expected that would be the case. But what you're going to get, whichever crew it is, are the people that deserve that world championship from the opposition that has been laid out there.
Look at that. Again, you're just a machine, man. We're going to go to the final item from Joseki 100. Any kind of update on Ginetta and their project? That's very open-ended. Yeah. It could be a garden. Yeah. They're doing in the back of the shop. quite a variety of options. What update should we provide?
Well, let's give you a couple of updates on it. One is to do with Ewan Baldry, the technical director of Ginetta, who many people will understand is no longer with Ginetta. That's because Ewan has been made a fantastic offer to come over to the United States and manage a automotive-based 3D printing operation. Which for a man of his experience and his stage of his career is an absolutely brilliant opportunity. I think Ewan actually flew yesterday. And before we get into it, has absolutely nothing, literally zero, to do with the LMP1 project or any other live project at Ginetta. Frankly, if I got the similar kind of professional offer, I have at least some knowledge of the terms that offer for Ewan, I would be hot-footing it towards Heathrow right now. It's a brilliant opportunity. As for the LMP1 project, I'm waiting for a call. And if the call is coming that I expect to come, it's going to come down to whether or not the Ginetta operation, and in particular the TRS racing operation, can persuade the LMEM and the ACO that they can pay whatever fines they're going to have to pay and that we could see at least one car on the grid for Sebring. I fundamentally believe that is now within grasp. Some fundamentals that were missing commercially from that program are now patently in place. Is it in time? We're about to find out.
Oh, look at that. A little bit of bait towards the future. All right, we are getting into the home stretch on ACO World. Rusalar asks, just read about the TDS non-finish due to not taking the checkered flag. I thought that the finish line extended all the way across the track, including the pit lane, so they shouldn't have counted as crossing the finish line in pit lane?
It wasn't that. I can understand why that was perhaps what the thought was that had happened. It wasn't that. What it needed was that Francois Perraudeau had to get back in the car for 50 seconds. It was a straight strategic miss by the TDS team. And unfortunately for Francois, as he tried to rejoin the track, the race was finishing and the pit lane exit light went to red. It was not about finishing in the pit lane. It was about the fact that he was in the pit lane when the race finished and the pit exit closed. So it was, I'm afraid, an error by TDS, and it cost them potential podium finish. So that was what that was all about at the 6 hours of Shanghai. Ruslan's question carried over from last week, but it wasn't what it perhaps felt like. It was that he needed to get back in the car.
So not Thierrier by TDS, but error by TDS. That, I believe, is a different team altogether. All right. Well, hey, let's go back to our pal 4SGTE. Why? Because it's a great question. Should WEC introduce tire coloration similar to F1 to make wets, slick intermediates, and slicks more easily distinguishable? There's a question about fuel flow, but let's just stick to this one since we've already covered a little bit of 4SGTE.
Yeah. I think anything that makes the racing more accessible, I'm not a fan of the pathos of particularly factory teams it comes from being coy about which tires are going on the car. We're here to give a show, and if we're going to describe that show, it is ridiculous that, you know, even commentators way more able than I am to call strategy should be unaware of what tires are going into a car unless we can actually get a pit lane reporter there to watch it. Let's help people to understand the racing, guys. We've got that RFID technology, and that should be able to give us an instant readout in some way, shape or form as to what's gone on the car. Not just the compound, not just wet, dry or intermediate, but actually, frankly, how many miles that tire has actually done. Now, okay, I can see how that might hand an opportunity to your neighbours, but you know what? Swings and roundabouts. There will be other occasions when it'll come the other way.
Well, let's also throw in, do you think your neighbours aren't tracking it already?
Oh yeah, I think so. It's for me. I'm just not a fan of, I want to see strategy. But I also want to see a degree of openness. There is proprietary products available now, and when I can finally get the laptop that I actually have in the commentary booth this year to behave itself for more than 15 minutes at a time, we will be able to give a lot more information on the real-time state of affairs with WEC Racing and strategy, because that's a key part. You'll know this from your professional background, MP. A key part of the difference between success and failure in endurance racing is the contribution of the guys on pit lane and the contribution of the guys and girls on the Pratt perch, calling the race into the ears of those drivers. And for me, any information that we can actually get to help to keep an audience informed and to keep them enthralled by that aspect can only be a good thing. So that's something I would like to see a little bit more effort coming into.
I'm going to move to the last two questions here, Graham, starting with Jatinder Dhaliwal, who says, "Hi, guys, loving the podcast. Thank you. With the next set of WEC regulations due around 2024-ish, will we likely see a, quote, boom time for manufacturers again if fuel cells turn out to be the way to go for road car development? We already have a few hydrogen stations in the UK, and it will only grow as the industry matures and people wean themselves off of fossil fuels." Let's just stick there. And there's also a couple of questions that Jatinder throws in about, focused on car, and some of the brands that might be involved, etc. But we're trying to make hydrogen a thing now. Great. But do you think we might go one step further towards fuel cells in, not just a handful of years from now? Or do you think that might be a next set of regulations?
I think it comes down to actually what it is that the original equipment manufacturers, that the factories determine is their direction. I mean, I'm a firm fan of the theory that says, boy oh boy, Formula E was lucky. Boy oh boy, Formula E was lucky that so many car companies played so many tricks with the rules and regulations applying to car emission standards. That is the principal reason that actually drove so many companies towards Formula E at a critical point. It's not to do with the quality of the product. It's not to do with the quality of the racing. It's to do with commercial expediency. And yes, we now stand at a moment when Formula E will take a big leap forward in terms of the standard of technology and competition. And, the proof of the pudding will be there. But the thing that tipped the balance in terms of the manufacturer punch was not the quality of that product. It was the timing of some of their professional colleagues in the road car industry being caught very much with their Lederhosen down. And that shouldn't be confused with it being utterly relevant to the here and now. As for fuel cell technology, I think the answer is that certainly appears to be what very many of those same companies are saying might well be the next great leap forward. It's going to come down, as Jatinder actually quite rightly implies, whether or not that technology is going to be mature in time to be usable, not just for motorsport, but for endurance motorsport, which is a whole different kettle of fish, whether or not that technology will be mature enough within a usable time frame for not the next regulations, 2020, 2021, but the ones after that, which we expect in around 24 to 25. That's certainly what, at the moment, the rulemakers are pushing along the lines of, and the indication is that there is significant interest from significant manufacturers in seeing that happen. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens around, as I say, the maturity of two things, the technology and the infrastructure that feeds it.
I also think Jitender asks a very sharp question, Graham, in that if we think about the duration of how long LMP1, and I guess you could say its predecessor LMP900, which, again, it's basically the same thing, but this LMP900/LMP1 formula, which has obviously evolved throughout the years, but if you think about how long the suckers lasted, you know, we're going to be at 2 decades of that being in place. I think when the ACO and WEC move to this hypercar, car thing, I think it's absolutely spot on to anticipate that the next set of regulations after it launches and the one after that, probably the one after that, are going to be more evolutionary than we're yep. just starting with a new formula altogether. So something like new propulsion ideas and systems, whether it's fuel cell or who knows what, I think that could end up being the trend. We've gone down this GT-style prototype. Now we're just going to either open up or restrict things as we get to each 3, 4, 5 year destination when some form of new tweaks are introduced with the rules. Let's go, my man, to our final ACO World question, that coming in from Matthew Hawkins, who says, mm-hmm. will Toyota be announcing any plans to stay in the series for next season, 19 and 20, considering they only said they'll commit up to the end of this super season? Any news or thoughts on this?
Thoughts I can certainly tell you is that they fundamentally will. I think that their language, and this language doesn't happen by accident. Remember, the situation here is you've got major corporation Toyota in Japan. You've got their motorsport arm, which is based in Cologne. And when their highly skilled spokespeople, that means the senior management as well as their PR guys, continue to use the same words, then you can be assured that's written in capital letters somewhere on a crib sheet that says, this is what you say if you're asked that question. What they continue to say is, we are committed to endurance racing for the long term. And that means we're going to be seeing them for some time to come. We're going to be seeing them, I'm absolutely certain, in the first year of Hypercar, if that's deliverable. And we're going to be seeing them next year with a very similar product to the one we've got this year, this season. So, yes, I expect they're going to continue. I expect they're going to continue beyond that. And I also expect that they're going to be amongst the organizations that can be very, very early adopters of zero emissions. Bearing in mind, from memory, I think they were the first manufacturer to bring a hydrogen fuel cell car to the marketplace as a production car rather than a prototype. So I think we're going to be seeing our friends from Toyota in Japan and in Cologne for some little time to come in the WEC and at the Le Mans 24 Hours.
Well, it's time to move to a different category.
Well, I think we're going to switch roles here, aren't we, for the most part? Although I think there's the first question up we might both be expected to give a quick answer for. We're going to go move effortlessly, seamlessly into IMSA world, the world of IMSA. Yeah. And I'm going to be the man who poses the questions now, Mr. Marshall Pruitt. We're going to start, and this is a common theme underneath this to a number of questions that came out, unsurprisingly, with the news that broke over the weekend. And the first question is, what are your finest memories of ESM racing, Marshall?
I would have to say their success at the 12 Hours of Sebring. I would say, their Daytona win being another one as well. I guess I don't have a single finest memory. It would be more of the manner in which some of their biggest victories were achieved. And I think I mentioned this either last week or the week before. Drama. Just pure drama. If ESM was winning the race, whatever it was and whatever vehicle, it seemed like there was a massive amount of drama associated with it. Some sort of heroic drive. Holy cow, how did you do that? Just lots of great drama. You can throw in some, not always, but some wonderful liveries attached to the cars. Those are the things that I'm going to miss. Great looking cars, a well-presented team, a team that usually had some very fun drivers, great personalities. So all around, it's a big loss, Graham. And
it is.
Of course, you could say that about every team. I would also say that, yes, sure, but there are also some teams that don't really contribute much while they're there. They race, they do their thing. They aren't necessarily looking at themselves as a member of the community, trying to better it, add quality, just enrich those in and around it. And ESM was everything but that. Great team, great people, gave lots, and tended to create some really big fun storylines too with some of those victories. So definitely a huge hole being left in IMSA.
Completely agree. And let's not forget they had a year with the WEC as well. And the other thing, and you push towards that there, MP, they were one of the few organizations that genuinely activated. You did see presence in the paddock. There were places where you could go and sample the sponsor's product. They had not just in the upper echelons of hospitality, but down in the paddocks of the world as well. For me, the look of the cars always stood out. That was a brilliant color scheme for a race car. And on the occasions when they did the odd special, those odd specials were there too. Afraid, sadly for me, one of my memories of them was a rather less pleasant moment, which was after breaking the points, and you were there for this one, MP, at COTA, that they would be moving to DP. It was looking up from my laptop to a very angry Ed Brown threatening me with all sorts of legals if it cost him his deal, which it was never going to cost him the deal to go and, let's face it, buy some Nissan Custom engines. But the reality was that he was a very angry man indeed about the fact that story came out before the press release. You know what, Ed? Sorry, mate, but that's my job. And I won't make any apologies for it. So that's the negative. The upside of it was, boy, oh boy, did they have some talent on the pit wall, in the garage, and very often indeed in those cars. Gentlemen and ladies, you are going to be missed.
I cannot confirm or deny whether I may have slid you that story. I don't remember the exact. Genuinely don't remember the exact reason at the time. I remember sitting there going, there was something. Usually it was probably a behind the scenes thing where I was like, yeah, boy, I'd love to break this, but I don't think I can without it upsetting some other things. So that's what friends are for, right?
That's,
I mean,
absolutely.
You help me, I help you. It works out. It culminated in a podcast that we do each week. Come on.
There you go. We move seamlessly from that into the reason we're talking about this, which is just for the if you're on a distant planet and picking this podcast up in 40 or 50 years from now when Lightspeed carries this through, that's Core Autosport out of the blue, MP, announcing that they would be parking their LMP2 efforts in lieu of actually taking on board the Ligier Nissan, and will be in DPI Racing. That basically confirms two things. One, we've got the Ligier Nissan back in IMSA competition, but two, sadly, that does mean the end of operations, racing operations for Extreme Speed Motorsport. And a number of questions about the Core side of things. Max Radke asks, with Core's decision to move to DPI class, what does that mean for P2? Will we see more Pro-Am crossover teams resulting in the death of P2? Do you think that DPI and P2 will coexist peacefully?
That's a lot of their questions. Let's see. Let's go to Max's first of all. From what I understand, and although I did not include this in my story, I believe this came together in about 48 hours. And my guess is, and this is purely a guess, but it probably wouldn't be too far from the truth, is having revealed whatever it was a month or so ago, that the AIM Vassar Sullivan team had purchased everything that ESM had, barring the Nissans, essentially transporters, all the equipment to run the cars, just everything except for the Enroque Ligier Nissan DPIs. It's very clear that the team was not moving forward. And the only way, as Scott Sharp told me at that time, that those Nissans would be on track with ESM being involved was if another team came in to partner with them and essentially backfilled all the infrastructure that they had sold off to the AVS Lexus program. Well, with that being very slim, slim odds, my absolute guess, Graham, is this. With a nice big shop to run this program out of for many, many years, having sold off more or less everything you need to run the motor racing vehicles, paying another month's rent and or lease and or any of the taxes. Just name all the things that a team would have to fork out getting to the first of a new month coming in with essentially just about everything gone except for the cars themselves. My guess is that there was a strong desire to make sure that the place was cleared out, and that is indeed what Core did. They bought all the cars, all the everything associated with the cars. Every piece of spare parts and you name it, took it all. They're only planning on running one car. So that is what they have in place right now. I know that we have the question there, obviously, of could they look to run a second one? You know, again, I'm sure, well, they have the cars if they want to. What I would say is, knowing Core's tendencies, they're not a team that says, hey, who could we get to pay us to run a second car just for the sake? That tends not to be their mindset and sensibilities for such things. So I think running the one car, as Morgan Brady told me they would be doing, with the four drivers that they listed, all returning from 2018, that's going to be the plan. Corey also asked, did Core have to pony up for the manufacturer fees for the Nissan DPIs? Without mentioning exactly how it was covered, Morgan also mentioned that that manufacturer fee and marketing commitment has been satisfied. So he said there'd be more to come on that, so we will have more information on that here soon, hopefully. But yeah, last week we said it would take a miracle, Graham, for those Nissans to be on track. So I'm not claiming that we are miracle makers, but clearly there was an impetus on ESM to get those cars out of the shop with the end of the month coming up. And yeah, within about 48 hours, the team went from planning to do LMP2, as they'd announced, to DPI. And when I spoke with Morgan a couple weeks ago, when they put out that, I guess a day before they put out that release, saying they were sticking to LMP2, you know, part of what he told me, and I didn't end up publishing it because it would have made me look silly, but he had said, yeah, we are very serious about wanting to do DPI, and we do have some options. We think we're going to end up going P2 next season, but, you know, we're not closing the door on that. And then 24 hours later, there's a story saying, eh, we've closed the door on that. My guess is there might have been another team that stepped in and said, hey, we really want these Nissans. So, again, just guessing, but I think there might have been a door that was open and then I think closed again and then opened again here late last week. So whatever it is, however it all came together, I am so happy that IMSA will be able to say that it has four DPI manufacturers next season instead of having to tell the tale that they lost one, because effectively nobody else wanted to pony up that manufacturer and marketing fee. So all good stuff there.
I should say, by the way, just in support of that, as to how much of a surprise this was, not just that weekend, not that week, that day, my colleague Stephen Kilby interviewed a pretty senior figure that has a direct involvement with that program, and that person was writing off the prospect that we would see those cars. That was the same day that we actually received notice that this was going to be coming forward. A quite astonishing turnaround, and you know, a welcome one for everybody other than those directly associated with Extreme Speed Motorsport. But you know what, guys, quality counts, and they will, I'm sure, not be lost to the industry. The last one on this one, it's a slightly different kind of tack on it from Joe Robert Siddeth, who says, with Core going DPI, could it possibly help Colin Brown's cachet getting more looks by IndyCar team owners?
I don't think it will hurt, Jerry, provided they're running up front and able to win more races. I do think, though, the narrative is a stronger one for what happened in 2018. Hey, we're the LMP2 guys that have been getting our butts whooped for a year and a half, whomever's had these cars. And hey, all of a sudden, we're now the giant killers. And by and large, it's Colin Brown doing amazing things, starting last or taking over in last and then driving to the front of the class. So it can't hurt, obviously, the more Colin is finishing in front of a Roger Penske or some of the other entrants in the class. That's only going to help. But I do think that it's a stronger sell, at least talent-wise, if we're talking about him being David, the others being Goliath. Now that he's a part of Goliath, even though Nissan has not so far been able to take on Cadillac for a manufacturer's championship straight up, head-to-head every round, I still think it's going to be a good thing. Would also mention, too, that I would not say that Collins' chances of being an IndyCar are completely closed as well. I think those discussions are going to continue for a while, potentially about being in a third Ray Hulettman-Lanigan car next season. And, we will watch that space as well.
Well, we're going to just skip a couple of questions in the order I've given them to you for the moment, because there's another overarching theme moving forward from the Core and ESM story, and it's about driver rankings. I know it's something you've written a little bit about, MP. Adam Smith and Kevin Perez-Frederico in a bit of discussion about Madison Snow and the sad news that he was going to be stepping away from motorsport in the aftermath of something of a debacle. Difference of opinion between what the FI driver rankings say, what IMSA say they're going to accept, Madison Snow stepping away from the sport. Adam asking, will we see Paul Miller Racing stay in IMSA GTD? Kevin suggesting that the only way you can see that is to hire, he says, David Heimer Hansen, presumably anybody else with the money and the talent. It's... Kevin asking around story that's been circulating that World Challenge might be actually in the immediate future for the IMSA GTD champions.
Yeah, this one, I don't think the story is finished. Mitchell Simmons, the Paul Miller Racing team manager, he had provided some quotes to another outlet saying that they were seriously looking at the series formerly known as Pirelli World Challenge, now known as Pain Face World GT Challenge America by Pirelli Course or something like that. Kidding aside, Mitchell mentioning that that was a place they were seriously considering, knowing that under their driver ratings, the pairing of Madison Snow and Super Pro Brian Sellers it'd be possible to continue working with them in a unique dynamic there. I believe SprintX was how they were looking to use them possibly. Regardless, too soon to tell. As for what they will do, I know that at least in the press release that was sent out mentioning that Madison Snow was stepping away, they kept mentioning would be unable to defend their championship. Madison being unable to defend, etc. I would say if we're using words and believing that there's intent in their use, Graham, if you're talking about a person being unable to defend their championship, that might suggest they have intentions to try and defend a championship, just with different people. Here's where things get a little bit ugly. We went into this a lot last week, so I'm not going to rehash all of that. But one of the key things we spoke on was one of the things that IMSA has done by uprating Madison to a gold/pro, leaving the team with two pros, the other one obviously being Sellers. They have forced the team to release one of those drivers. It's certainly, in my not humble opinion, nowhere near the right or just the correct action for any series to manipulate or force a team to have to hire or fire somebody. All that being said, though, I think what we saw initially from the team, especially with the comments from Mitchell, was great and grand support from Madison. We love that kid. We want to keep working with him. I believe Madison then saw the reaction to that, Graham, and helped them, decided to essentially retire, at least from IMSA. I'm not saying we're never going to see him in a race car again. I hope that isn't the case. But Madison solved the problem, if you wanted to call it that, so that the team could stay in IMSA if it wanted to. I know, just from paddock chatter, that Madison was highly regarded by Lamborghini. And, it wouldn't surprise me to learn that the manufacturer Paul Miller Racing is involved with was very bummed out to learn that they wouldn't have this kid back in this number 48 entry. Where does this lead them? Definitely a hard call. Think about this. if they were to go to the series formerly known as Pirelli World Challenge and continue to use Madison, in theory, Madison could continue bringing some financial support that makes it easier financially for Paul Miller Racing to keep going there. If PMR decides that IMSA is the place where it wants to continue and indeed defend its GTD title, well, Brian Sellers is a paid driver. They would need to find somebody to come in as his amateur, as his non-silver, I'm sorry, as his non-gold, non-platinum teammate, who likely also brings a budget. So this is where this gets a little bit ugly, especially at this hour, Graham. Especially, yep. Call it 1 month away from the roar. We have a team with a championship-winning car, a championship-winning lead pro driver, an empty slot in the AM position, and about a third of the budget having retired. I don't know what is going to happen for Daytona, because that is obviously the immediate puzzle to solve. If they're just looking for what do we do, how do we do it in the meantime, getting to and through Daytona is the big push. You then have a little bit of a pause until we get to the Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring in March. Would it surprise me to see a good selection of AMs in the car alongside Brian to keep racing, just at least embark on a 2019 championship in IMSA? No. Would a decision on whether they keep going in IMSA after that or go to World Challenge be more of a post-Daytona announcement? Again, unless someone with the money and the right driver rating steps up or that they feel really good about, I think they're just going to be in a bit of a hard way. The true bottom line here is, I know this doesn't mean anything in the grand scope of competition, but this was the team they wanted, the team they loved. Brian and Madison had been together for a couple years. This is just a true family feeling. Like, just everything about this was warmth and happiness. This is perfect. And now that has, not only has that perfection been lost, but just that feeling of, boy, the fun has kind of been lost here in this, what's happened, our appealing to get his rating changed, the denial of that appeal through IMSA. So this is pushing back on Paul Miller specifically to make a decision on what he wants to do, if he wants to continue racing, whether he would have fun or feel compromised or dirty or something getting back involved with IMSA and spending his money there. Beyond all the other things here, I'd say this is going to be a real test of one of North American sports car racing's more enduring names. You know, back to Paul's days as a Trans Am entrant and driver in the 1980s and so on. Paul's been around forever. His team's been around forever. They've raced all over the place, enjoyed it, had a lot of fun. Is this the thing that makes him say, yeah, maybe this is enough. Maybe I've had enough. If this is what I've got to do, I've got to essentially fire a kid and or have him quit racing on our behalf to do this. So that, to me at least, that's the bigger question we're going to have solved here very, very soon.
Well, it is a darn shame, isn't it? It's a talented young man. Skipping a couple of others to deal with some wider themes. LMP2, because of course the Core Autosports decision to move to DPI does leave some questions about the depth for the season of LMP2. And it doesn't seem that long ago, MP, that we were talking about sources suggesting there might be very healthy numbers indeed in LMP2, but it's gone very quiet. We've got a number of people, our good friend Status, back from Army Service Duties, asking a number of questions about that. Alec Eichmiller, asking whether or not there's any odds that there's an IMSA P2 program we haven't heard about yet. David Schutt asking something specific about PR1, having removed the AFS logo from their Facebook presence. What do we know?
Not as much as we'd hoped to, my friend. We start with last items first. I did catch up with our pal Bobby Ergel, co-owner of PR1 Matheson Motorsports. Spoke with Bobby, I think, on Thursday or Friday. I was very gracious in thanking Gary Peterson for his involvement. Got a little story update coming out here, so I don't mind mentioning what it is. But the Oreca 07 that they used to close the season, that is in his possession, that is their car, that will be continued, that will continue forward for next season. We don't know how much, though. While speaking with Bobby, I did mention that I'd recently been in contact with two drivers, and or those drivers contacted me asking if I knew of any LMP2 efforts looking for drivers for the Rolex 24, so I shared those with him, and I think at least one, if not both drivers, might end up working out. But again, we'll see. That's for them to figure out. Beyond that, I'm really in a case of needing to catch up with P2 team owners and or car owners. From general discussion, I've heard that the Oreca 07s that JDC Miller/Gainsco used last season, which they are not using this upcoming season because they're now Cadillac DPI entrants, that they still have those have yet to be sold or leased or otherwise. Need to check in with Brent O'Neill. I called him last week, haven't heard back from the Performance Tech team that also runs an Oreca 07. For looking at Pierre-One Matheson and Performance Tech, those are the two, I would say, highest potential candidates, Graham, to embark on partial season, full season, something season, knowing that they still have them, still going to use them. If we look at, this is something where there's a little bit of a Facebook debate going back and forth over the weekend. There were a few folks who were critical of IMSA deciding to stick with the LMP2 class they announced. I did speak with Scott Atherton, IMSA president, on Thursday or Friday, and he mentioned, look, we take great pride in doing the things we announced we were going to do. And they announced in early August that they were expanding to a split prototype class, DPI LMP2, DPI full pro, or whatever you want, P2 specifically pro-am component. They had five cars that were consistent participants in the LMP2 portion of things at that point, Graham. We had the JDC Miller Gainsco team with two entries, Core with one, PR Matheson with one, and the Performance Tech team with another car. So that's five. Realize that Performance Tech took some time off, et cetera, but essentially you had five cars that were in regular rotation. Within a couple days of the announcement of the split class program, we had JDC say, hey, by the way, we're leaving P2 and we're going to DPI, where that's a little bit, it's a little bit curious, my friend, is that team had been the loudest, most frustrated proponent for splitting the classes. And the minute the classes got split, a couple days later, they say, thanks, great, by the way, we're going to DPI. Now, do I think that their frustration had built enough to the point where they'd been down the road of going towards the DPI while behind the scenes, these plans were being hatched by IMSA? Yes. It wasn't some sort of, aha, now that you've announced it, we're going to go get DPIs. And they did that business in a matter of 48 or 72 hours. But if you look at the numbers, five LMP2s, we've now lost the two JDC Orecas and just recently now lost a third Oreca, that being the Core Autosport entry. So just sharing that while it might be easy to snipe at IMSA, when they made the announcement, it was at the beck and call of the majority, not all, but the majority of LMP2 owners saying, hey, give us our own thing. IMSA did it. With essentially five cars in rotation. Going into December now, we're looking at two on the more potential part-time, full-time. Not talking about any special entries that might come in for the Rolex 24 or might, stay over from the WEC race on Friday and play on Saturday at the 12 hours of Sebring. But that's the concern. And I don't really know of any other teams planning on jumping out with a car that we aren't aware of. There's still time, though. As I mentioned, those JDC cars still there. I don't know if or what Core Autosport might want to do with their now mothballed Oreca, but there are cars available. And we know, Bobby Ergel also told me, Graham, that they still have the Ligier JSP 217 that they ran, which if somebody wanted it, they can buy it. They can do whatever they want. So not saying that they're only Orecas available, but there are plenty of cars. If people wanted to use them, just concerned that after Daytona, after Sebring, we might, As I mentioned to somebody, I'm not sure, that I've spoken with in the last couple days, I'm not sure IMSA will have a need to order more than 2 champagne bottles for the LMP2 podium at some rounds. And that's a concern.
It is. I mean, one of the other things, Statis also asked the question, is Dragonspeed the only LMP2 team left the field? Well, you've quite rightly said, there's the Dragonspeed have confirmed they intend to contest the Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona. So have RLRM Sport, by the way, stepping up to LMP2.
Yep.
I'm aware there are some doubts about another part-time effort for IMSA, which I hope to confirm the situation with that in the coming days. So tricky days right now for the LMP2 field, but you know, in some ways that's because of positivity elsewhere. There's not been a net loss in terms of the teams that were contesting P2. They've stayed with the series and in a higher profile category. And I think from Core Autosport's point of view, and it'd be interested in your point, your thoughts on this one, it is highly unlikely, to my mind, that Core Autosports were attracted to those Ligier Nissans with those cars being offered at full market rate.
Yeah, I think there might be something there as well. Again, maybe I'll find out more here in the coming days, but I'm guessing that there was a serious discount in place. It's not as if Core, it's not as if John Bennett and his variety of companies, it's not as if they are lacking in funding. So that's maybe good point to offer here. It's not as if they're not known as the bargain team. They're just also not known as the spending stupidly team. And so my guess is there were some serious financial incentives, new incentives that came in for them to say, hey, okay, let's do this. And for them to acquire everything, both chassis, all spares, you name it, for a single car entry, you know, that would suggest that one heck of a package deal was put in place. I'm also going to make another assumption. In order to run those cars, there's also some form of contact or contract or something needed with Ligier for support, production of parts and pieces. Definitely with Nissan as well for those motors. Mm-hmm. So this isn't just a case of buying cars and running them. This is also opting in to continue the support, making sure that those 3.8 twin turbo V6s turn up and work well, and their support technicians to operate them, blah, blah, blah. Plus there's the spending the approximately $1 million for the manufacturer registration fee, plus the majority of that commitment. It's not an upfront check from what I understand, but the majority of that commitment goes towards marketing funds. There's a lot of extra bells and whistles that cost a lot of money in order to do this. So again, my guess is, upfront at everything at full price, it's something that would make most teams blink. I'm guessing that across all those levels of support, minus the manufacturer fee, been told that there's really no willingness to reduce that number for anybody. But in terms of the other partners' commitments and you name it, that this must have come together at a price point that finally made sense to the team. And good on them for stepping out on this, right? They could have just made a commitment to Gibson to keep running that 4.2 liter motor. And beyond that, just gone and played at a privateer financial level, which would definitely have been a lower number. So good on them.
Let's run through a couple of quickies to finish off the IMSA World part of this one. Steve Smith, Jr. Hey, Steve. Do you think MP Toyota might be looking at starting a DPI?
Lost you a little bit there, but you'd asked, our pal Steve Smith had asked if he thought Toyota might be looking at a DPI. No, I haven't heard nothing on that front, at least in the near term. We've mentioned a couple of times that Lexus, in their once desired DPI program, that has died, that has been taken off the table. Would that be revisited potentially here a couple of years from now when IMSA says it will be effectively choosing a new round of DPI regulations? I'm sure they would be back at the table. But on the Toyota front, I don't know if we would see anything, Steve, in IMSA that is straight up Toyota, since Toyota already spends a massive amount as that brand in NASCAR. I don't know if they would then choose NASCAR's sports car series to represent that same brand. So I'd think whatever happens in the future, obviously we have the AIM Vassar Sullivan Lexus RCF GT3 GTT team that's going forward here. But anything on the prototype front, I think if it were to happen, it'd be next generation regulations in under the Lexus banner.
Another quick one, actually, so relative to the Corvette Racing Program, we've had some questions about this in the last week or two. Max Radker asks, with Corvette Racing using the C7R again, which they will through 2019, is this concerning to the future of the program, or is this simply a case of more development time for the C8R?
I am not particularly concerned. I'd hoped we would see some C8R-ness in IMSA, at least, in the upcoming season. Would I rule out the possibility of that at any point in time? Not necessarily, but yeah, not really worried. I think just like many had hoped that we would be getting it soon, something fun. I can't really offer a whole lot beyond that, Max. We know that they have it. We know that they're working on it. We also know, as the defending champions, it's not as if the C7R and IMSA's ability to apply balance of performance adjustments to it. We know that that hot rod is still capable of going very quickly. Granted, the driver's champions happened to win that without winning a single race. The sister entry, that being Tommy Milner and Ollie Gavin, were able to win this season. So do I think we're definitely heading into a year where the last molecules of performance to unearth from the C7R will be taking place? Yes. I would say just as they'll be celebrating their 20th year coming up at Le Mans, all that, we definitely need to treat this as a farewell tour for this beautiful chassis.
Two quick questions, MP, to finish what we've got with a bumper crop there with IMSA and lots of stuff going on there. Ice Coffee asks, at the Encore, TCR cars were running with and around the GT4 cars. Will TCR cars continue to run at that new baseline performance into the full season next year?
One of the things that I need to follow up on, to be honest, yes, they were uncorked a wee bit at the Encore. I know that there was a desire to try and see if better alignment of the performance for those cars could be possible. I think that was achieved, but yes, to your question, and I don't have an answer yet, but I do need to find out, is that something we'll hold on to? Because that would certainly be fun. Fast TCR cars are just an awesome thing to behold. So yes, I'm hoping the answer is yes, but it is something that I need to chase down.
Final one comes from Kevin Payne. It's another question hanging over from last week. And Kevin says, they're heading for the Rolex 24 from the UK with their good friends and travel destinations. Know that they know Le Mans well, having been many times to the Porsche curves, but would welcome hints and tips on how to prepare and get the best experience possible at Daytona.
Oh, well, first of all, not sure if you plan on being a soldier and partaking in the entire 24 hours live, or if you plan on heading back to a hotel, dashing to the car for some sleep. I'll just mention that while there aren't many corners, and you cannot get to the vast majority of the track from the outside, if you're looking at places to buy a ticket to just strictly sit and enjoy, something in the major grandstands behind the front straight, closing towards turn one up high, would certainly recommend that. You can see everything, just about every single inch of the track. So that would be the first suggestion. If you're looking for a ticket to buy, to sit and just see what you see, one of the great things they've added, Graham, with all of the Daytona expansion there, is they have some actual food that you might want to buy and eat. So there's been an upgrade in food quality. There are proper facilities there if nature calls. It's much less of a feeling of being high atop the wilderness and more feeling of, oh, I'm at a very modern sporting venue where they have the fan in mind. So that would be one thing to try. The other thing, and you know, it's beautiful up there at night. You can see all kinds of great stuff from there. Other thing I would mention, and I mentioned this about some tracks, Circuit of the Americas is definitely one of them. Elkhart Lake Road America is another. It is a touring track, something that, again, barring the grandstands on the outside, there's really no other place to go where you can view from the outside. Everything else is about inside viewing. Great thing is with either a backpack and everything you want, hopefully a little fold-up chair, a little awning or umbrella or something, you can walk around and see just about every part of the track. You might not necessarily be standing, you know, face pressed into the fence in some areas, but you can see the vast majority of the circuit, and that just involves a willingness and desire to roam and take a tour. Last quick thing that I'll mention at the track with all of that in mind, if you're getting there for the practice and all the goodness there on Thursday and qualifying on Friday, then 24 hours of racing spread across Saturday and Sunday, it's a big facility. It's not a lot of corners, though, as I mentioned, which means you can see a lot of the place, if not all of it, fairly quickly. So I would just say that if you want to still leave a little bit of mystery, what you might find, what angles you might enjoy if you're bringing a camera or otherwise, you know, on Thursday alone, you could probably see just about every inch of the place. So just as I do, and I think other photographers do, same thing applies with photography. You can shoot just about all there is to shoot in one day, so you try to spread it out a little bit so you aren't bored going back to the same spot for the fourth time, and you're only into the early afternoon of the 24 hours. So just pace yourself. That would be my other main suggestion.
Great stuff. The one thing I'd add to that is it can get pretty cold. Don't think it's Florida, therefore I'm going to just turn up in shorts. You could be lucky, but at night it gets bitterly cold if that wind whips in. So do come prepared for a bit of weather. Right then, MP, with not that long to go against our self-imposed deadline on this one, you want to switch to some of the kind of more general, more entertaining
general
stuff?
General and fun, you say? I love that idea, my man.
What?
Let's boogie.
Go for it. You want to start?
Yeah, I will be the monkey waving the green flag, starting over, general and funnies. Let's see. I see anytime I see something involving driver ratings or BOP, I kind of start twitching a little bit. So I'll go, let's see. What did we... Steve Kowalczyk says, Nürburgring seems to be the most famous among jumps. Any other tracks that stand out for having considerable jumps? Are there any left, or have they all been tamed?
Well, I'll give you one immediately because it's where I'm going this week, and that is Fuji Speedway. And the extraordinary story of the original layout of that track. And it originally designed Fuji to be a NASCAR-style oval, but they ran out of money and instead made it a road course. But the final straight, which many listeners will be familiar with, this hugely long drag strip of a final straight, which now finishes in that torturous right-hander off camber roller coaster, actually used to carry straight on through what is now the gravel trap and indeed the hoarding, and over a rise, over a crest, dropping into the speed bowl, which is still there. So the old banking that initially was turn one of this Fuji Speedway is still there, and you get a chance to look at the topography of that and see just how profound a crest that was. And indeed, I am told cars would get air through there, and indeed there were some horrific shunts which eventually led to the track being fundamentally changed. But Fuji, and every time I look at it, it makes me bold to think of the kind of cars, effectively, in US terms, pretty close to kind of Can-Am style cars that would be coming through there. Take a look. YouTube's got some good black and white footage of the track in those days. Running that track in the wet, in particular, must have been, that's the kind of thing that makes your butt cheeks clench, methinks.
Other than seeing you naked in my radio room at the 24 hours of Daytona.
Again.
That's number two of making my butt cheeks clench. I'll just throw in the Thunder Hill circuit has, I forget what corner it is, it's right in front of the pits, and it has a big old yump. little funny, maybe. It certainly wasn't funny at the time, but the person who I paid to build one of my endurance racing cars, amazing fabricator, also someone maybe short on interpersonal skills who was not keen on being told, hey, are you sure you want to do it that way? He, while welding in and installing the mounts for the air jack system on the car, installed the rear single post air jack while the car was in the air. And so I said, isn't that something you'd kind of want to do on the ground and then measure the length of the fully deployed air jack and then place the actual welded mount that it is contained within based on all of these things and tires lifted up? No, it'll be fine. I can measure it. Yeah. So we went testing with the car for the first time at Thunderhill, jumped the jump, and I'm watching, you know, this awesome display of sparks trailing behind the car, and that's because, just as I had mentioned, had he just maybe did what I suggested, or had I been more forceful in saying, no, I won't let you do it that way, let's just say that the height was completely wrong, and when I flagged the car to come in, I found that almost everything, the entire pad that extended from the air jack, thankfully didn't get into the ram itself, but yes, it had been returned to the earth because the frickin' downhill slide of that jump was just, oh yes, it didn't leave much behind. So that's one that, you really do have to navigate that, and you can make up some good time if you are brave and on the right line. So that's another one that comes to mind. We are, Graham Goodwin, sadly, we're right on that hour and a half. Do we give ourselves two or three more questions here? Because we've got a lot we haven't gotten to.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to make a suggestion. It's a radical suggestion, but it's what? The one I'm going to make, which is, let's go for a couple of the generals each, and I will run through really quickly right at the end a couple of the questions that came out of the results of the GT Nations Cup at Bahrain. So maybe a couple of the general and funnies that we've got here, then I will answer a couple of quick questions from Bahrain because I know some of the answers to some of those questions, which is always a good reason to answer them. I'm going to crack on and say,
I'll take one from Cruel Monk quickly because I can answer it quickly. Recommend a sports car racing book that doesn't focus on the 24 hours of Le Mans. I would say that you would be doing yourself a fine, fine favor if you either purchased Hurley Haywood's autobiography that he did with Sean Cridland. And I've mentioned a couple of these recently on podcasts, so I might be covering similar ground, but they still stand out as rather amazing purchases to me. The one I would say, by and large, which I believe is just out or just about to hit the old stores, is the IMSA book 1969 through 1989, written by Mitch Bishop and Mark Raffoff about Mitch's father and mother, John and Peg Bishop. And having seen many chapters of that book, I pre-ordered it. It's not about the 24 Hours of Le Mans. It is just amazing. It is beautiful. It has some great words inside of it and even better photography. So if you are a fan of IMSA, especially its heyday and crazy stuff, including the drug years, that would be a smart purchase to make.
I'm going to go for one from us, a new listener. Never heard of this person before. Shay Adam.
Hey, welcome. Who says,
that absolutely. Is. Yeah, I've never heard of her. If it's a her. Which GT driver would you like to put an LMP1 car at Le Mans who's never raced that class there? For Shay, it's got to be Larry V, Lawrence Fantura. What do you think, MP?
Oh, Lord. I love questions like this. It always reminds me that my brain needs to retain more so I can answer it without sounding like a complete idiot. Well, if we're talking GT driver, that one's very, very easy. One, Ronald Scott Dixon. That would be he of the 4 GT team. Also, he of 5-time IndyCar champ. And he of, why hasn't one of the world's greatest race car drivers been inside one of the world's fastest prototypes? He's won Daytona before in a Daytona prototype, which I'm kind of using air quotes to call a prototype. Yeah, Scott Dixon, period. End of everything.
For me, Simply because I'd certainly like to see the way this goes. Nicky Team would be an interesting one to see. He's got massive, massive, God-given talent, that boy, of a Lawrence Vanter sort of nature. And I would pay to watch what I think would be briefly one of the best wheel-to-wheel duels, with Lawrence Vanter going wheel-to-wheel with Nicky Team. What happens at the first corner, I have no idea. But I'm telling you right now, it would be in the highlights reel.
I thought you were going to say our man Till Bechtelsheimer, but you know, I guess I'll continue to dream big dreams. So you wanted to do Mr. Press the Old Throttle here. So what should we close on?
Let's go. Let's crack through really very quickly indeed. Just a few of the SRO questions before we pack this one up and send it off to the internet. As he scrolls down and tries to find those questions. And they are there. Okie coke. Number of people: Robert Northway, Jordan Hopwood, Josh Barrett, Mark LaFan, etc., etc. Any chance of the FIGT Nations Cup becoming a pro driver competition? No. We've already got the FIGT World Cup for that. Robert asking, after the talk about the GT World Cup at Macau, should the GT World Cup move to another track? Yes. It's a ridiculous place to have it. Where should it go to? It should go to Bathurst. That's where it should go to. And I'd love to see that as a support race for the Bathurst 1000. That's what I'd like to see. Jordan asking about evolution of GT4. Any chance that brands like Lotus and Maserati, once popular in the class, revamp their GT4 efforts? Well, they're going to have to do it. They want to be competitive. We saw Maserati compete and compete with a little bit of success last week, but you're right, it's slightly underwhelming. Enjoyed, did Josh Barrett, the non-pro bronze silver only combination in Bahrain. Could we see the format used in future SRO championships? This is an event that I have to say surprised me that it was as good as it was. Driver standards, yep, silver, bronze, was somewhat unquestioned. Certainly the start of the feature race, I think that needs to be looked into. But I would love to see this expand in the future. I'm not sure sending it to Valalunya in November is a perfectly smart answer. Maddock UK says Turkey won the GT Nations Cup victory. There was a mention of commentary, a good idea to race on at Istanbul Park. It won't be happening, but could you do it Eurovision like that the winner stays on, if you like? The problem with that, it's a lovely, neat idea, but it ignores the fact that not every nation that wants to compete has got a relevant circuit to play with. Case of the prosecution, Hong Kong, for starters. I actually think what they've got is the right formula. I think switching it around is a good idea, but I think you need to take into account one factor and one factor only in that, which is the weather. That's what's going to draw more competitors. I don't think this will be a major spectator event. It's a pro-am thing. It made for great TV though, and I really like the idea of getting this thing to expand into year two.
Is that it? Are we done?
That's it for the map. That's done. There'll be some interesting stuff, by the way, with a catch-up with Stefan Rittel on this front and others in the coming days on DSC. And I hope on Racer 2, if I can squeeze some stuff there that's going to be of interest to the good folks at Racer.com. But, yeah, we're getting very deep now into the racing season, MP. I've got actually still 2 weekends to go now. With the second round of the Asia Le Mans series at Fuji this coming weekend, and now just confirmed that I'll be hopping along to see the racing debut of the McLaren 720S GT3, the Aston Martin Vantage GT4, and the first customer cars for their GT3 version of the Vantage at the Gulf 12 Hours at Yas Marina the week after that.
Yas Marina. All right. Well, if we didn't get to your question and you would really like for us to answer it, please send it in again when we ask for more questions next week. It's somewhat depressing, Graham, to think that we're here with the first weekend of December coming up and your season isn't done and you've got more after this weekend, but one of the many reasons we love you. Or at least I do.
You know what? Well, very few do, but the ones that do so passionately. But it is a strange thing to be this deep into the year and still be doing this stuff weekly. And by that, I mean double E, not EA, weekly. But it doesn't seem that long ago that there was a 6, 8, 10-week gap, but that's, I'm afraid, now ancient history. Looking forward, though, to bringing some interesting racing. Let's wait and see with its great racing for the next couple of weekends, and there will still be more questions to come. We'll be carrying this one on through to the end of the year and into the new year, and that first anniversary that you and I will celebrate skipping along the main straightaway at Daytona International Speedway.
Arms intertwined. Sipping Absolutely. Champagne flutes. It's going to be a beautiful thing. I'm so happy that we're kind of sort of at a real, just a little bit over hour and a half, not a Marshall Pruitt hour and a half, but almost kind of just sort of a real hour and a half with a few extra minutes in here just because there are too many good questions. They're all good questions. We just couldn't get to all of them. So again, please send in the ones you want us to try and get to next weekend. Other than that, I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. Thank you to you, dear listeners, and all the questions you sent in via Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. And thank you to our kind, kind patron that makes all this possible, Cooper Tires. We'll speak to you next week, the week in sports cars.